WTF is Retail, presented by Excellent Zephyr.
So today we are joined by Chris Brown, the former global retail director of Ted Baker and the co-founder of Kit London, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I've got to say co-founder of Ted Baker there. No. Co-founder of Kit London, yeah.
So if you want to learn more about Kit London, we have a previous podcast for the listener's sake with Kitty, so you can go listen to that. I would like to say, first of all, it's amazing to have you on. Someone with such experience at such a reputable, kind of well-known brand. This is, you know, the first time we've had someone like this on the show. So I think our listeners and retailers tuning in will be really interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm just I'm actually just delighted to be here and meet you two guys, because you've been telling me sort of what you get up to. Yeah. And my biggest passion is that retail's alive and kicking, and there's exciting things coming. But you know, if I go back to my career, I started when I was 12 years old. So I worked in a paper shop, and I started in retail because I did a round, but I'm a bit of a clever so-and-so. Within about 2 weeks of doing the round, and it was cold, it was like November time when I started the round, I worked out that I could stay inside the shop if I marked up the papers. So I'd mark up the papers for all the other boys, the dresses of where they were going to deliver the papers to. I told the boss that, the shop owner, and he said I couldn't do it. He said, it's too difficult. And I said, which is probably run through my career, I said, you're doing it so badly, I can definitely do it better than you. So it was sort of like a challenge. And he said, that challenge, he said, all right, come in on Saturday morning, worst day of the week. If you know your paper shops, Saturday and Sunday, Sunday's even worse. Saturday, everyone gets their supplements and their magazines and their comics and so on. So I went in Saturday morning, 5 a.m. in the morning, like child slave labor. I marked up the papers better than he did. I made him and his wife a cup of tea, brought it to them in bed. And that was it. That was my job all through junior school. I had that job, and I worked in a pet shop selling tropical fish. So kind of by accident, I was supposed to be bright. My dad always said I was the bright one in the family. Mm-hmm. But I fell into doing retail, and I just loved it. Serving, selling, seeing how I could move the shop around or do clever things with the displays or the windows to attract, and then getting a result, instant feedback on how it sold. So I started retail very, very young. But if you speak to a lot of retailers who've had my kind of a career, they've all got stories like that. Right. Mine's not made up. Yeah. A lot of theirs are made up.
Well, we want to get on to the in-between then. Yeah. That leads perfectly into my first question, because I was going to ask, how did it all start? That's how it started. How do you go from marking up newspapers and the paper rounds to working at Ted Baker? What's in between there? Obviously a lot of hard work.
Well, I took a bit of a diversion. So when I was 17, for various family reasons and needing money quickly in the family, I got a job in a bank. So I worked in a bank for 3 years. And they actually do call it retail banking now, which is serving. Initially, you work in the machine room. I mean, this is all like, ancient history to you guys. You're younger than me. But, you'd actually process the checks in a great big machine that would stamp the check with a barcode, and then it would go off, and it had to be parceled up and sent somewhere. And it was all physical. So I did that for 2 or 3 months. Then I got a job on the front counter, so I'm serving customers. And that, again, dealing with people's money is quite different to dealing with products and selling people products. Mm. So it's quite fraught. You've got to have really great skills to cope with the various anger that would come across from customers in the bank, or sometimes delight if they've got, done well with money. So I did that for 2 or 3 years, but I woke up one morning and just thought, I'm not a banker. This isn't for me. Working in a bank, it's a bit of a dry environment, if I'm really honest. And at the time, it was very bad news in the family that I decided, I just walked out. I just literally said, I'm not doing this. I told the bank manager I was leaving. He made me do a month's notice, but I left. Mm-hmm. I spent 6 months on a building site. So I'd love to claim that I can build brick walls, and I could. I didn't. All I did was make the tea, get clipped over the head by the builders, and then they'd spent my wages at the end of the week in the pub. And that took me, because I was a bit stupid, took me 4 or 5 months to realise I wasn't actually, I'd leave on a Friday, £50 in a brown envelope, and go home with £5, having spent £45 on their drinks in the pub. So realised building wasn't for me, and effectively I found a job in a shoe shop, just a shoe shop down in Brighton, serving old ladies, children, clerks. It wasn't clerks, it was John Farmer. But John Farmer was a branch, effectively, of Clark's Shoes. And I learned to sell and drive sales in a shop in Brighton. And again, I realised these previous 7 or 8 years, the pet shop, the paper round, and even the banking, had all led to my first day in the store just went brilliantly well. And at the end of the day, the store manager said, I was a full-time sales. He said, look, you're doing so well. He said, I'm going to give you the assistant manager job. That was on my first day. working in the shop.
Wow.
So my salary went up by £1,000 a year straight away. And I was just, I remember going home that night thinking, wow, you know, I must have done something right. And what it was, and this is a lesson for anyone, I didn't really realise that by doing things off my own accord, so I'd see that there was a piece of paper on the floor, I'd pick it up. I'd see that a shoe turned slightly, I'd go and turn it. I just did things instinctively. I tidied up the desk. I cleaned up, there was ink stains all over the desk where people had laid pens down. I went and got the cleaning fluid out. And he said, no one's cleaned that desk for like, you know, 5 years. And I cleaned the desk up. So I started realising I had standards that were imbued in me, probably from my mother, from the years of actually working in shops already, that were just not the norm. So if I've got a tip for anyone listening to this about not just retail, just working in general, work for yourself. You know, work hard for yourself. I treat every day as another day in Chris Brown PLC, you know, never mind who my employers are. And so that was the beginning of it. Then I met the area manager towards the end of that week, and he made a comment like, wow, you know, this kid's like, you know, top sales, coming up with ideas. I got put onto a graduate management training program. So I was 17, what was I then? Sorry, 19 years old. I've never been to university. Mm-hmm. Got put on a graduate management training scheme with that company. And off the back of that, learned all sorts of skills from stock taking to finances to whatever. So I got a really hard grounding from the Clarks organization in brilliant standards. So you understood merchandising, you understood how to stock take. And so when I went into, later on I'll come on to my TED career, but I made certain that anyone that I came into contact with, so when I was training people, you became rounded. You learned every part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I don't want to say this generation's not doing that, but I think sometimes now retail's always been a bit maligned as a job. It's a stepping stone to something else. Whereas I would say to people, it can still, and still today, not, you know, it's not the 1980s, in 2022, you could start on the shop floor in a store and you could work your way up to CEO. Absolutely, I believe that. And some people might be listening thinking, oh, well, there won't be shops around in the years to come. Well, you know, you're going to ask me that later. We'll talk about future retail. Yes, there will be. It's a still leisure activity. There's still, you know, a requirement to work on the high street. So then I went to work for a company called The Tube. I was very into my music. So, you know, you name any famous band from the 80s and I probably saw their first gig. So I saw U2, for example, in front of 30 people in Brighton. I think it was their second ever UK gig. And all those kinds of bands, The Cure, Joy Division, I saw it. That was my obsession. And all of that was really going on mostly in London. There was a little bit in Brighton where I grew up. So I'd go and see bands and hang out with bands, and I thought, I've got to live here, I've got to be in London so I can go to gigs more often and I can be around more often. So I got a job at 100 King's Road, again, ancient news now, but King's Road was the hub of British fashion and the main shopping street really for cool fashion back then. Obviously it's all moved over here now to Shoreditch and Hoxton, and interesting places in East London.
Yeah.
But effectively I ran a store down there serving celebrities like Princess Diana would come in once a week. You know, Jack Nicholson was a regular shopper with us. Jean-Paul Gaultier, who was obviously a huge fashion icon even back then, he would be strolling the King's Road looking for inspiration and ideas, and he would come into the store. And so even at a very young age, you know, 23, 24 years old, I'm actually running this cool store. My shop was called The Tube. It had really interesting shoes. Celebrities, top models calling in, stuff being called out to go to photo shoots and magazine shoots, magazine editors coming in. And I was handling all that as the store manager. I mean, if you saw a photo of me back then, you'd be shocked. I looked about 9. I mean, I was skinny, small, but, you know, I must have had some sort of charisma or confidence about me that sold it to them. Similar thing happened there. I got made the sales manager 3 months after I joined. So I joined as King's Road store manager at 23. Before I hit 24, I was the sales manager running 12 stores for them. And then there's this lovely story about how I met Ray Kelvin, who's the founder of Ted Baker. We were opening a store in the Plaza, which is still there on Oxford Street. It's actually a next sort of mini department store now. But it was a shopping centre. And I was in the window of the Tube, a new store, getting it ready for opening the next day, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning on an October night in 1987, pouring with rain, and I kept on noticing, I was doing the window, and I kept on noticing this strange guy across the street staring over at me with another guy, and I was thinking, they're going to rob the place, or they're going to come and attack me, or something's going to happen. And eventually he came over, tapped on the window, and insisted on me coming out, and I did that trick where I put my foot behind the door to try and block the door if he did try and push the
just
door
just in
open.
Case
pulled it open ever so slightly. I said, you know, what do you want? And he said, come and talk to me, we're in this game, come and talk to me. And this isn't going to sound true, but it's true. So Ted Baker's history was, it was a shirt specialist.
Yeah.
Right? That was the first thing we did. What niche marketing, niche retailing it was called, and you just sold shirts, no other product. I went out into the street, got chatting to him about all sorts of things. He was asking me about the tube. And eventually he said, I just want to ask you one last question. Where is there a gap in the market in the UK for menswear? What would the gap be? What would you do? Like, you know, we talked about Sock Shop and Tie Rack. And I went, shirts. I said, you can't get a good shirt. You have to, they're all imported. You go to Wayne in Harrods, you have to get a French shirt or an American shirt, whatever. And he went, that is fantastic. He said, you'll do for me. He said, we'll be in touch. And off he went. And I just thought, guy's a weirdo, he's a tramp, you know, he's yeah. whatever.
Wants to steal your ideas.
Yes, yeah, just, you know, imagine 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. But we met three times, actually, because I was very suspicious. Three times I met him at his manufacturing company offices, and he started to explain, you know, he kept on mentioning this chap called Ted who would like what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And eventually I went, are you Ted? Is it you? And he went, wow, he said, no one's ever asked me that, but yeah, I'm Ted Baker. Obviously, he's Ray Colvin.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of it. So I switched from the tube where I was doing really well, and I just thought, this guy's got something special.
And sees something in you, obviously.
And he obviously saw something yeah. in me, and took me on as his, effectively the first employee of Ted Baker.
Really?
And I flew up to Glasgow to see the shop when it was a building site, the first store. And the other first store was Sheffield. I always get upset with that. They should have opened on the same day, but they did. Long, boring story, so I won't tell you. But effectively, the Sheffield store and the Glasgow store were opening the same day. I was in charge of the Sheffield store, and we got delayed. But I moved to Sheffield, and then we opened stores in Manchester, Newcastle, Nottingham. And this is the bit that everyone doesn't know now. Obviously, the brand's maybe had some tough times in recent years, but for 6 years, we changed ownership and financing three, maybe even four times, certainly three times. And it was just going bust and going bust. And my first partner, mother of my oldest two children, kept on saying, why are you working at this company? It doesn't make any money, it's laying people off, it's having troubles. But I just believed in it. And I don't think today, 2022, you'd spend 6 years trying to make the thing work. You'd probably give up.
Yeah.
You know, 6 weeks maybe.
Yeah.
So effectively that was it. I got involved in TED, and I had this amazing opportunity to effectively set up the retailing, set up the way that we did things, find all the staff and create retail. And this is the bit that perhaps it doesn't really come out in the press ever. I was obsessed, and I'm obsessed today with A, excellence, but B, I wanted to be, this might sound ridiculous, but I wanted to be the best retailer in the world. Mm. That was my aim, not to be, you know, one of the best in Britain or the best in London or whatever. I used to say it to the team all the time, we've got to try and be the best in the world. Now, whether we got even close to that, I don't know. We certainly got a reputation and we did very, very well, and people would say, wow, your teams are amazing and the shops are amazing and the atmosphere is amazing. You know, I'd love to say I did it all. We didn't do it all. We had great shop designers who created amazing environments for the stores. Very theatrical, you know, compared to perhaps things a bit more minimalist these days. Mm-hmm. Our shops were really theatrical. You know, you'd find a stuffed flamingo in the shop, or you'd see, you know, a moving Santa Claus, or you'd see a train going around the building, you know. Yeah. So we tried to entertain, you know, retailers' theatre. Right. And that's been lost now, in my opinion.
Mm. Okay. Maybe we've bitten off more than we can chew. I know there's so much you want to tell us, but I will get Harry in for the next question.
Sure.
So we've kind of got to the point of you, how you got started working with Ted Baker. Really interesting backstory there. But during your time at Ted Baker, what were kind of like the biggest challenges you had in growing the brand? Is there any story or particular scenario that stands out to you where, you know, there was a certain challenge and you had to overcome it? Could you tell us a little bit about
probably the single biggest challenge is something that and I would say that I can't actually remember exactly how this decision came about, but it was a decision that affected us in a good and a bad way. So we early on, I sort of remember it that Ray made some comment about not liking advertising, not liking fashion advertising, and it was all much the same and a bit boring. And I had a similar view from, like, if you opened a magazine, you could cover up the brand name and no one would know what product it was. Mm. You know, Prada, Boss, Gucci, whatever. I mean, maybe you would if you really know your stuff, but the general public wouldn't know. So we both had this view that it was a bit pointless. And he was very much about, I want to do something more direct marketing. And he'd had this idea that we should make our windows really, really, like, incredible, moving windows to create excitement. But when we used to tell the city that, like, years later when we floated the business, you'd tell the city you don't advertise. And they're just horrified. You know, how can you have a fashion business and not advertise? I mean, it'd be like, you know, a young brand today saying we're not going to use social media. It'd be a similar kind of stupid thing to say. So, yes, it was a challenge, but it was a challenge that 100% I agreed with. I didn't like that. I didn't like TV, radio, or you know, print advertising the way that it was done. And I love the idea of trying to come up with creative things in terms of direct marketing to customers. So we did all sorts of weird and wonderful things to get attention. So one of the most memorable ones was, and this came out, again, my memory of it is it was a brainstorming meeting, and the idea kind of grew into something ridiculous. And it started out with Ray saying, I want to give the customer, when they buy a shirt, give them something they're not expecting, just whatever it could be. So I don't know who said it, him, me, someone else around the table, but we basically came up with the idea of, why don't we give them a goldfish? And again, I'm looking at you guys, you're too young to remember this. When you went to the fair and you were a kid, right, you'd play the various games, okay, where they sort of cheat you, you can't get the ball in the bowl. Mm-hmm. But there'd be goldfish bowls with goldfish in them, and you'd throw the ball into the bowl, and if you got it, you won that goldfish, and you took it home in a bag. Right. So your parents will 100% know what I'm talking about. They will know what I'm talking about. So we're all laughing about it. It's quite funny to us, all the same generation. We'd get this goldfish and we'd just give them the goldfish in the bag. We can't give them a real goldfish. So then it became, well, let's carve a carrot into the shape of a goldfish. And then there's a meeting went on. It was like, let's suspend the goldfish on a string so it's not even touching the water. Let's dye the water blue so it's really kind of looks quite showy. And then let's write hand wash only on the bag. And then the most important bit, it was a bit Monty Python surreal, mm-hmm, was when they bought the shirt, or, you know, in the store, we did a few other things by this time, we'd hand them the goldfish and say nothing and walk away. And then when they said, well, why have you given me this? Go, well, don't you normally get a goldfish when you buy something? And of course they'd say no. Well, what do you do? You're doing Ted Baker. Memorable. What would then happen though, they would go and tell lots of people. Now, mm-hmm, this was viral marketing in its purest form, because they'd go and tell them, I was in Ted Baker yesterday and I've got a goldfish when, yeah, I bought my... And then people would come and go, are you the shop that gives out the goldfish? Now, yeah, that really spiraled into something I'd say is my proudest, one, probably nearly my proudest achievement in the company. 1994, one of my colleagues said to me, the World AIDS Day, the first World AIDS Day, you know, the red ribbon that's ubiquitous now, that was released and coming out for World AIDS Day. And he said, my colleague said, can we put a poster up in the shop announcing World AIDS Day and support it in some way? Just before that, I'd had a bit of a row with Ray over putting a poster up for a club, clubs, because we had tie-ins with clubs. So I said to the guy, no, we can't put a poster up. Ray went nuts when I wanted to put a poster, can't advertise another business, but this is charity. So I said, what else have they got? And he said, well, they got this red ribbon. I didn't know what it was because it was new. Mm. I said, well, it sounds quite cool though. Well, we'll have the red ribbon, we'll have the little box, and we'll put that on the counter, and that'd be great. And then I said to him, what about if he gave every customer a condom? And he was just laughing. He was in London, I was in Sheffield. And he was laughing his head off. He said, you can't give customers condoms. You know, we're all like little schoolboys going, condom.
Yeah.
It's rude. So I said, no, we can, you know, it'd be great for a week, just for World AIDS Day, we'll give them a condom, we'll support safe sex. I mean, it was the days of, in the cinemas, you know, icebergs, and it's everyone's going to die from AIDS, and it's going to be the biggest catastrophe on the planet. And effectively, I created with our graphics team a condom packet. I'm doing this, you can't see this, you can see it on the video. A condom packet that was like a little matchbook cover, and my clever idea was to write all of the branch names on the back of the packet, and if you've got a condom inside it, I was thinking most guys will take the condom, we were menswear only in those days, they'll take the condom and they'll keep it because it's useful, dead useful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I even think that some people came into the shop to buy a shirt rather than going to a chemist and buy a condom, because it's, you know, yeah, oh, got one of those condoms, mate, and take the condom.
Yeah.
So we did the first one, but I actually rang Ray up and he told me not to do it. He said, it's a stupid idea, don't do it. But I went ahead and did it anyway, because again, I told you I'm a bit feisty, full of myself.
Do what you want.
He then went into the shop on that Saturday, which I didn't think he was going to do, at the Covent Garden store, but he rang me up and he went, these condoms, and my heart sank. I thought, I'm going to get the bollocking of all time here. And then he said, they're great, aren't they? The customers are loving them. It's brilliant. So that was that. Fast forward 6 weeks, new window for January, into January, because it was December the 1st we did that. He rang me up, he said, where are the condoms? And I went, oh no, it was just for World AIDS Day, Ray. We didn't do it for, no, that's it. He went, no. He said, I they're great. They're part of the brand now. I want a condom designed to go with the window schemes. Whatever the window scheme was, the design went onto the condom packet. And for the next, I don't know, dozen years, every 6 to 8 weeks when a new window went in, a new condom design came out. I believe we had people that came to collect just the condoms. Yeah. They're hysterical. If you see, I've got the collection at home.
Oh, really?
When you see them, it's like something like, I don't know, 200 different condom packet designs. Just, I won't say it on here because some of it's rude, but whenever you put something on a condom packet, the whole meaning of it changes, shall we say? So you could put something quite innocent on a condom packet in the theme of whatever it was, better in than out, for example. Like we have a cabinet reshuffle was one of our windows, and it said on the condom packet, better in than out. So it suddenly becomes rude on a condom packet.
Yeah.
So that was just great fun. And actually, when we launched in America, someone said to me, you definitely can't give condoms out to Americans. And this was a guy in America, one of our guys, a Brit. running our New York store, he said, they'll be offended. And I said, you watch me. We start giving con numbers out in America. They weren't like Brits. They were like, hey, man, give me six. I'm having a good night tonight. They were like, they were cool with it. Whereas Brits were like, oh, can I possibly have a condom?
So
the condom thing was funny and hilarious. And it wasn't bandwagon jumping. And it wasn't laddish. It was actually meant for a very, very, very good reason, you know, to protect people. Like, you wonder now, unwanted pregnancies and saving people from sexual disease, we played our part. So
absolutely. Yeah, lovely. Absolutely.
I guess moving on from that, during your time within Ted Baker... and I know you kind of said you like to talk a lot about future retail and things like this. And I guess if we rewind a few years, this is a similar kind of topic. Is what kind of changes in the retail space did you see and experience during your kind of long time at Ted Baker? Was there kind of drastic changes where you had to kind of keep reinventing yourself? Yeah. And, you know, because obviously retail was changing a lot then, right?
Yeah,
at
yeah.
At that time, I imagine.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's probably half a dozen sort of big moments that, things drastically change. So the first thing to say is there's always big downtimes. You know, we're talking currently of this downtime and this cost of living crisis and how it's worse than it's ever been. I do slightly have to pinch myself and go, and anyone listening to this, please don't hate me for saying this, but it's not as bad as the 1930s, you know, when people were walking to and nobody was working and 3 or 4 million people were unemployed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not as bad as the 1970s when there was the three-day week and candles lighting schoolrooms, you know, and people massive amounts of people out of work. I mean, it really is a difference of, you know, they've said the recession stroke the problems of today are like, well, you can only have 3 holidays this year, whereas, you know, back in the 70s, you didn't have 1. You know, you'd go to my family. We actually flew to Spain, which is rare. Mm. Most people went to Bognor or, you know, a week on the Sussex coast somewhere, or they might go to visit relatives and stay with them. That would be a holiday. So I do think it's slightly overblown. But those recessionary times, actually, if you see it in a slightly different way, they can really sharpen up what you do. And that's how I prefer to see it. So this period right now, people are thinking about pivoting. Look what happened in COVID. When COVID came along, we had to pivot how we even thought about, you know, it changed everyone's views about commuting to work. You know, I work from home more often. And I see it on jobs now. Virtually every job says hybrid.
Yeah.
Or there's another word that means that is the opposite of that, which effectively means it's totally work. Remote. So you'll say remote. That's come into the parlance in the last, 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
So if you go back over sort of my time, yes, we launched in a recession. We went into the early 90s and, you know, great time. So in 88, we started the business, but in the early 90s, you know, huge recessionary pressures, you know, housing price collapse, everyone's thinking it's Armageddon. But if you can survive through those times, so yeah, the things that we were good at, you know, we weren't relying on advertising to be famous. A great line that I used to use was, we earn our customers, we don't buy them. Right? And that line played quite well with the city when years later we were trying to explain why we didn't advertise. And it's true. If you are giving every single customer that comes into your location an amazing experience, and, you know, I don't know which companies or brands or hotels or restaurants you've been to and thought, wow, that was a great experience. But normally we've got more bad ones than good ones.
Mm.
You know, we can all come up with a bad experience. We'll come up with a bad experience of shopping, a bad experience in the restaurant, wherever it might be. And I used to drive the team mad. We're still going to have those, but how can we make certain we don't? So we developed processes. So we had a thing. One of the ways we coped with it was we had a thing called Excellence Day. Excellence Day was amazing. So you had to give me, everyone had to give me an hour of their life, which might sound big, but 5,000 people around the world. All you've got to do on Friday night is go to bed 1 hour earlier than you were planning to, or you normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what that means. If you go to bed at 3 in the morning, go to bed at 2 in the morning. If you go to bed at 10, go to bed at 9. Give me that hour. And then you're going to use that hour by coming into work 1 hour before your shift starts, whatever time that shift starts. We did this globally. What we asked them to do was get your hair cut, buy a new outfit, whatever it is that's going to make you feel amazing on that day and feel like an excellent version of yourself. And then throughout the day of Excellence Day, it had nothing to do with serving or selling or the customer experience, but in a roundabout way it did. And then what we asked people to do was be the excellent version of yourself and keep that energy going all day long. And we had timeouts built in as well. So we'd say, if you're feeling the energy drop or the excellence dropping a degree or two, ask to go and have another cup of coffee, break, walk out in the fresh air, whatever you need to do. Everyone support each other. And so what actually ended up happening was the buzz in the company around the world. And we did this, the first time we did it was in one of those recessionary periods when, you know, times were tough, trade was terrible, people were saying, is retail, I think they were saying, is the high street over, even then, 30 years ago, 25 years ago. And we had the most amazing weekend. But the point of Excellence Day was why is that the one day of the year it's okay to be excellent and 364 days it's not? So the learnings that then come out of being excellent for a day built into the business. And we used to spin that event every year, one day only, and a new generation would experience it. Then we actually rested it for a few years, then it came back before I left the company. We reintroduced it. And it was just an electric day. And what was funny was, or interesting was, people would not want to be sick on Excellence Day. So sickness plummeted. They wanted to be there because everyone would be buying, people would be trying to outdo each other, bringing in donuts or chocolate or making bacon sandwiches in the morning, whatever they were doing, to outdo each other. And people look forward to Excellence Day. So it had its own kind of momentum. So that's one of the ways in which we tried to do something, A, different, and B, to kind of solve the problem, if you like. The windows would definitely be something that ran through the business. And it upsets me. The window I've just seen on Regent Street is actually pretty good, quite a loud flashing kind of lively window. So it lights up your Christmas, I think it says. Right. Not bad. But we used to do these wacky windows. And the windows, when Kitty and I used to work on the windows meetings together at 10, which is why we know each other so well. But the windows was just a celebration of irreverence and fun and smutty English humour at times and, you know, entertainment. And I used to look at the other brands and think, why are you just putting a mannequin in your window? Why are you just doing this boring version of retail? So that would be one of the ways I was trying to think, how can you make retail more entertaining and exciting?
Yeah.
Starting with the window, then when you come into the store, you probably all experience the Gap greeter, goes, hello, welcome to the Gap, welcome to the Gap. And they have to say it to every single customer, welcome to the Gap, welcome to the Gap. It's really boring, really, really boring. Mm-hmm. We used to do a thing called hello training. So I came from a visit to America and getting sick of people going, hey, have a good day and whatever, how's your day going, whatever. They're not, no interest. We did hello training. Hello training runs to about 80 different reasons and points and skills in how you say hello to somebody. So there's a way in which you can say hello, which makes the person think that you already know them, which I won't bore you with trying to do now, but you say it in such a tone, and Soho House are very, very good at this. They make it seem like you're an old friend. So we developed that, but we said sometimes, look at the person's demeanour. They don't want to be greeted like an old friend today. You've got to be a psychologist and work out. So we did massive amounts of work on that type of, what to the customer, you wouldn't even notice it particularly, other than you come out of it going, they were nice in there.
Yeah.
They were good. They gave me exactly what I wanted. I mean, you must have been in shops where you don't want to be served. I used to drive everyone mad. Don't sell to customers. There's nobody likes being sold to. Yeah. Nobody.
The worst place for this for me is a shoe shop. Sometimes I just want to go in, look at a few shoes, and they're just on you.
Yeah.
And it absolutely doesn't. It's a real pet peeve for me.
Well, you'll like my line then, Harry. So I say to people, I used to say to people when I was serving in the shop, my line was really simple, don't worry, I'm not going to serve you. and everyone would go, oh, thank God for that.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be me. Yeah.
And I study that. None of this is by accident. I am literally, the other thing I was going to throw in of one of the ways in which you solve the problems of retail, I'm obsessively reading, not just business books, any kind of book. And I can get stuff from all sorts of books. I'm helping a young guy with a business at the moment, mentoring and helping him. And I sent him a note yesterday. I'm starting with these two books, but there's another 20,000 I'm going to recommend to you over time. But start with these two. One's called Being Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh, who's I think he's Vietnamese, might be Thai Buddhist monk. Right. And he has pieces in there about how you portray yourself, how you conduct yourself, how you feel about life. And it's just a beautiful read, and you read it and just feel better about life. So that's the first one. And the other one's a thing called The Fred Factor, which I recommend to you both as well. The Fred Factor, it goes back to my original point about working harder than anyone expects you to. And this is all about a postman who just goes above and beyond the call of duty. He looks after people's cats. You know, he takes their dogs for a walk, because if I'm walking around the block anyway, I'll take your dog out with me and I'll walk the dog and then bring the dog back to you. He's in America. And you read The Fred Factor and you just go, wow, why doesn't everyone think like the way... And the guy was called Fred. My son's called Fred, funnily enough. But why doesn't everyone think that way? And I would imbue the teams with this attitude. Don't do it because we're telling you to. Don't do it because you're being paid for it. Don't do it because... Do it because you think it's a good idea. And we'd have to work on making them think it was a good idea.
Yeah.
So I had lots of things which I would think were firsts in how retail improved and got better and why Ted was so great. And it was obsessive to me, as you can probably gather from the way I'm babbling on about it now. It was obsessive to me to find excellence in everything, from the displays, the windows, the customers' behaviour. And the other big thing was, I know a lot of people don't even want to work in the shop. That's completely fine. But when you're here, and it's another 24 hours or 8-hour shift of your day, give me the best of you, and then you can go and do what you want.
Yeah.
If you want to go and be a graphic designer, or you want to go and sing in a band, or whatever you want to do, if you find most people are a better version of themselves when they're not in the shop, you know, when they go out. And I said, that's completely fine. I get it. You know, I'm the same. I'm a sports player. I like playing racket sports, and I play that obsessively. but I give as much energy to my work as I do to the hobby.
Yes. And you mentioned, you know, a couple of new things that you're doing now, mentoring, working with Kitty, for example, on this new brand. I wanted to ask you about that sort of post Ted Baker life. When you left there, did you know straight away what you were going to do, or was it a bit, what came next, and how easy was it to
find
that?
The best way of describing that, Theo, is I left suddenly, so I wasn't expecting to leave. You can work out what that means. And I actually thought for a while I was just going to retire, which is ridiculous. I was 55, and I thought, well, I'll just retire then. You know, that'd be me. I like gardening, I like racket sports, whatever. And that lasted about 2 weeks. So after 2 weeks, I just started having one or two things come my way, one or two offers. I didn't want a full-time job, was a big thing. And actually, I did an awful lot of work for private equity, which might sound a bit dry, but actually, when you spend time with them, I worked with an amazing company called Advent International. And I did three or four jobs with them, and the detail that the more financial thinking, and I like to call them quants, because the detail they go into is just ridiculous. I wish I'd learned what I learned from them when I was in my career at TED, because there was so much stuff they picked out from I worked on four or five brands that they were considering buying, so that was fascinating. So I was doing that on a sort of part-time basis. That was great. I started doing some non-exec work for a couple of small companies, and again, that was fascinating. This is a problem, I think, actually, with startups, that might be interesting for people to hear. When you're a startup, and if you go on LinkedIn, you'll see the startup companies, and it will say CEO, CCO, whatever. I have a bit of a view. Hopefully, this is not an old-fashioned reactionary view, but it's quite hard to just say you're a CEO just because it's your company and you've started it, so therefore I'm the chief executive of this company. Being a chief executive really has got deeper meaning, and so has COO, and so have all the other C-suite roles. Really, you need to have had, you don't necessarily have to put 30 years in, but you do need to have learned and had some experience and done the hard yards, or done some hard yards. So I think there's quite an opportunity, and this is where I came in, to effectively go in, and especially if it was an owner-driver. So the owner, the person whose idea it was, owns the business and nominates themselves as CEO. They don't really know the skills and the leadership skills and the man management skills and the strategy skills they perhaps require to run the business. So I started doing some of that. So although I wasn't a CEO at TED, I had a role a bit more akin to a managing director. I didn't just run my department. I got involved in other departments too. So I had a much broader view of the overall business. And I try, certainly with the business I've helped and the ones I continue to help now, get them to see that they've got to just broaden out their thinking and understand, a little bit more detail, because then that's where the problems come. Because a problem will come their way and they don't know how to solve it, because they've had no experience of solving that problem. And yet they're the CEO. The CEO's supposed to know.
Yeah.
And they don't know. So I do think that's something, and I think just, in a nice, with humility, people out there who are listening to this who think, well, I'm a CEO and I know what I'm doing, just have some humility about it. Because my attitude would be, even now at 60 years of age, I don't know loads of stuff that I still want to learn. I'm staying open to learning, developing, bringing in new skills. Certainly when I was 24, 25, I was hungry for information.
Yeah.
So keep that open mindset and absolutely learn more stuff. I just wanted to say that on the sort of what else am I doing, I've invested in a paddle tennis club, which we haven't got time to go into here, but I've got a paddle tennis club.
Something I want to do, by the way.
It's in Australia, in Sydney.
Oh, really?
I've been talking for the last year about starting the paddle revolution
it's happening.
In Australia.
I've done it. I opened it in 2019.
Okay, I was too late anyway.
So 50% of that is, and actually one of the issues with that is that the partner that I had, very nice guy, but he was supposed to be doing the retailing side of it, and he really hasn't kind of got hold of that or done that in the right way. So I do that. I'm also working with my local club to put paddle courts in there. I've got a paddle court in my house.
Cool. Oh, really?
I'm quite obsessed with paddle tennis.
Is it popular in London paddle?
It's literally just starting. I mean, so if you go back, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, we all thought the paddle revolution's coming, and then it kind of died out. It didn't die out, but it just didn't go anywhere. So other European countries have really grabbed hold of it. Yeah. Like Sweden, Ibrahimovic has invested a big chunk of his fortune opening paddle centres of 10 paddle courts indoors all across Sweden. In the UK, really in the last 2 years, it's started to really motor. So there's lots and lots of courts going up. Seems to be a huge amount of press start suddenly. And it was in the Sunday Times at the weekend. It's now really getting... Now I think is the time it's happening. And certainly my local club, they're going to put two covered courts in with a view to put five in eventually. And they want to make it the kind of premier paddle club down in Sussex. So, I've been involved in it for 20 years, so kind of ahead of the curve on that one.
We could do a separate podcast.
Yeah, I'd be very up for that. Yeah,
but I will pull us back to retail because I know that is your forte. Kit London, I wanted to talk a little bit about that very briefly because we spoke on the last episode with Kitty, and she mentioned that obviously you have a lot of the ideas that are going to drive Kit forward. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing there and where the brand is going.
So Kit's interesting because we started out with the thought that we were just going to do effectively some graphic t-shirts and sweatshirts and keep it quite simple. And then as we started working on it, we were like, well, if you're going to do a sweatshirt, you should do a piece of knitwear. If you're going to do a knitwear, and then obviously my history and experience, 30 years at Ted Baker, and we were shirt specialists, we were like, well, we've got to do a shirt. Mm-hmm. So obviously I'm wearing the shirt.
It looks very nice, by the way.
We put a lot into this shirt. You know, it's got the shadow pocket, it's got the poppered buttons here, it's got the taping just to give it a bit of an edge to it there. Possibly got too much going on. And then I put a bit of glamour on it, just one jewel button down there, just as a little surprise at the bottom. All sorts of touches running down our red stitching detail here. But so we did a beautiful shirt. I was really really thrilled when the shirt arrived, having designed it and worked with one of Ted's former designers helped me with it. And then it's very odd. So with Kit, I don't want it. It might sound really weird. I don't want it to get that big. Mm-hmm. I've got this dream really of it getting to a scale where there's almost like an amount of money that it makes, and that we keep it to that kind of amount of money. So argument's sake, let's say it's £5 million a year. If it's doing £5 million a year and it does 5.2 next year and 4.8 the next, I don't want, one of the things I didn't like about my career, even though I was good at it, is that constant drive to get 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% more every year, every year. Mm-hmm. Eventually you hit a ceiling and then you start to go backwards. And even the biggest companies in the world, I mean, look what's happened this year. Amazon share prices come off, Facebook had the biggest share price fall in history, Twitter's gone pop for Mr. Musk's different reasons. He's gone and dropped bonds on it. But fashion brands, it happens to them too. Ralph Lauren was at an all-time high a few years ago. They're fighting their way back now, but how can you be unhappy when a brand's done 5 billion or 6 billion, but last year they did 7 billion? So, oh my God, it's a disaster. We only did 6 billion. So I kind of fight against that mindset a bit. And at times, I'm not saying Kitty doesn't understand. She completely understands what I mean. But it's a bit of an odd mindset to have, to say, let's not just go too big. In fact, we've already gone bigger than we wanted to in terms of what we offer and how big it is. I'd rather go back, and this is what we're talking about at the moment, pivoting backwards slightly and saying, right, let's do a couple of products so unbelievably well.
Yeah.
I was going to bring it. I haven't actually got it with me today. I've created a jacket, right? And hopefully you'll like this. In fact, you should both be the first two customers for it.
Yes.
We didn't have a chore jacket, a workwear jacket. And, funny, we're in Shoreditch here. It's the home of the workwear jacket. Everyone's got a workwear jacket. But your workwear jacket has to be, it's got a provenance to it. It's a baker's jacket, or it's an railway engineer's jacket, or it's a foundry worker's jacket. All the brands that do chore jackets, work jackets, all they'll say it's the same jacket that's been made in France the same way for 100 years, Or Carhartt. I was talking to Ben, one of your colleagues, about Carhartt, how much he loves Carhartt. Mm-hmm. It's a farm worker's jacket.
Yeah.
So my jacket, breeding off all of those influences and provenance issues, I created the Slovakian chicken farmer's barn jacket, right? So, and it is fictitious. I made it up. And the reason it's Slovakian is a good friend of mine is a TV star in Slovakia. Yeah. And I was talking to her about it. And I thought, oh, Slovakia, that sounds quite unusual to people. So we'll call it Slovakian chicken farmer, and it's a barn jacket. But it would work if you were a Slovakian chicken farmer, or indeed an English chicken farmer, the jacket would work. It's got a split on the sleeve, and the split on the sleeve is a little pouch where you can put grit, because when you have chickens, you have to give them grit to go in with their food. Mm-hmm. Or you could put mealworms in there, and you put the mealworms down to get the chicken to get off the nest so you can steal its eggs more easily. You can just knock the chicken off the nest, obviously, but a nicer way is to put some mealworms down.
Yeah.
And then on the jacket has got a little tab on the front and two tabs on the back, depending on if you're left or right-handed, and it comes with a net bag that's tiny but can expand, and that's for collecting your eggs in. You clip it on the front, clip it on the back, and you keep your eggs in there. And then the pouch that the bag sits in when it's not in use is a great big square pocket that you effectively can't reach the rest of the time. So it's around the back of your back here. So every part of it, if you were a chicken farmer, would work. But when you look at the jacket, it's just a great chore jacket. Mm. It's in a really, really robust fabric. Because one of my things, I drive a lot. I hate getting in cars and having to take my jacket off to the back of the car, especially if it's a cold winter's day. So it's a sort of jacket that you could literally, virtually destroy it on a drive and crease it all up, and when you get out it'll look fine, it'll look exactly like it was supposed to look.
Super cool.
So we've made the sample of it. I actually did have it with me, and I haven't stuck it in the bag, but we're going to produce it at some point, and importantly I'm going to do a men's and women's versions, because chore jackets, workwear jackets are always for men, and women can't get a version. The amount of women I've shown it to have gone, oh, I'd love that.
Yeah.
So we're going to do women's sizes in it too. But what I want to do is go back to going, let's do a chore jacket really well. Let's do a more robust version of this shirt so we'll fit. We'll do it in a tougher fabric.
Yeah.
Let's do a killer pair of like combat stroke workwear pants. Carhartt would be an inspiration. So a lot of what they do, I like, my son wears a lot of Carhartt. And I think some of their provenance for that is real, because it's real farm workwear. So that's what we want to do, is scale it back and go, right, Kit now does, because it's meant to be Kit in all sorts of puns on that word. Kit, Chris's Kit,
yeah.
Kitty's Kit, Kit for clothing, but also Kit for life. So you get one jacket that's your best jacket. You get one pair of trousers that's your go-to pair of trousers. And then the plan is, which is very different to virtually every brand out there, we're not going to make other stuff. We're just going to keep making that jacket. So if you want the Kit Slovakian Chicken Farmer's Barn jacket, we'll have it in stock. If you want our brilliant shirt, we'll have it in stock. Because I used to have an idea for a brand called One. And the idea behind One was you buy it once and you have it forever.
Yeah.
I was thinking once or one, but One I preferred. So it was going to be One. And there'd only be one shirt, one trouser. Mm-hmm. There'd be the perfect white shirt, the perfect whatever.
Cool.
So we're just debating that now, how we go back to it. Because you do have to stand out in the crowd now to be something. To be.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, talk about the future, just quickly. I am, as I said to you, obsessed by the future. And the metaverse. Mm-hmm. And I went to an event, brilliant event. My friend Harveen Gill ran a brilliant event for 75 British retailers.
Yeah.
And halfway through the event, they were all being very cynical about the metaverse and whether it was relevant to them and their brands. So I couldn't help myself, because I like to stick a knife in sometimes. I just said, can I speak? And I said, there's various people here being cynical about the metaverse. They're the same people who didn't jump on the internet bandwagon 20 years ago and probably are struggling to get their online working really well. And I said, without naming the names, I knew some of the ones that I just said, without naming any of their names, I've got a stupid joke, I named all their names, said all their names. These people are the same people that when the metaverse does go seriously live and seriously successful, they'll be at the back of the queue. They won't be trading on it. They won't be trading well. When they do decide to trade, no one will be interested because they're so late coming to it. And they're saying it's not relevant to their customers. Yeah. Today. Go forward a couple of years and you won't have those customers. They'll either be dead or not buying fashion anymore, and the new customers won't be looking at your brand. And there's countless brands where that's happened to, which we don't need to go into, but there's plenty of brands where that's happened to. So
very interesting.
And I don't necessarily think the metaverse is going to be, perhaps, you know, we're all going to go on and buy digital clothes or whatever, but there'll be digital experiences. I mean, they say that the trainer world, within 3 years, the digital trainer world will be worth more than the physical trainer world.
Wow.
You know, which is just astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give a name check to a business, a friend of mine, Sneaker Thief. They've gone in a year from no brands on their platform to 1,000. And effectively, nothing's digital at the moment, but they're exploring that. But effectively, if you want a hard-to-find pair of sneakers, you go on Sneaker Thief and you can find it. When the idea was pitched to me, I'm not a sneaker fan, I don't wear them. I don't wear trainers or sneakers.
Mm.
Just because I like sport, so I wear them for sport. I think it looks too casual, personally, but you go around the streets, everyone's wearing sneakers. It's a sneaker world, isn't it? Like, another good friend of mine runs a business called Lockie. Brilliant sneakers if you want sneakers. I'm not trying to promote them particularly. Lockie sneakers are vegan.
With them, actually,
they're amazing, amazing. Emmanuel and his brother Frank created an amazing brand. But it's just not my thing. I don't wear sneakers. But in the future, when you're living half your life in the virtual world, I mean, come out in your offices in a minute. There's people just heads down in computers. 5 years from now, if you can do all of that, but you could actually... Like, let's say you wanted to switch to being at the game and you could actually be in Qatar and feel like you're in the stadium, watch the match as if you're sitting next to people in the stadium, which is what it's going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the metaverse. Mm-hmm. And then if at the end of it you want to buy a Qatar shirt to put on your avatar that you sit in the stadium, you can click the button that says buy a Qatar shirt or an Argentina shirt or a Germany shirt. And if you want to see your avatar eating a burger, you can buy a burger. All of that stuff's going to happen. Do I want to do it? No, I don't. But do I think it's amazing? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing. Yeah. And I think... everybody should wake up, and it might morph again, you know, who knows. 3 or 4 years from now, there might be, I don't know, the uni metaverse or something, and they go, well, the metaverse is yesterday, we're not doing that anymore, we're doing this now. It's only going to get more crazy and more amazing and more wild. You know, if you only go back 100, 120 years from now, people didn't fly planes. 120 years later, we think it's nothing.
Yeah.
120 years ago, if you told my great-grandfather you're going to go up in a metal box in the sky. He'd have thought you were absolutely mental.
Well, so, Harry still doesn't do it. I'll just get that out on the podcast.
Do you not? You don't fly?
I do fly.
You just don't like it?
I don't do it very often. Oh, right, but I don't like it.
Right.
Thanks for dropping that in there, mate.
I reckon I've done 1,000 flights, right, because I've spent my whole life flying around the world. And I, every time I go up in the plane, I am thrilled like a little boy. I can't believe that this thing takes off, goes above the clouds, you know, over the countryside. So I don't understand people not being incredibly excited by the future of the metaverse, the future of retailing. Retailing's got to change a bit faster. I mean, this is a horrible period right now. Coffee shops and barber shops and not much great retail. You know, you don't see it in Shoreditch because you go and see these cute little boutiques selling cool, eclectic stuff, and that's brilliant. But you start going out to the provinces of the UK and it's a wasteland. So I'm hopeful that it gradually will come back. I'm working on other projects such as reviving the department store and creating department store's the wrong word for it, but that box that was called a department store, making it a seriously entertaining hub of interesting brands, boutique startups. The best coffee shop in town would be inside the department store. The yoga school would be in there. The workplace, you know, workstation place would be in there. You can make it amazing. There's one in Sheffield, Barker House. Is it Barker House? Got the name wrong. There's one in Sheffield anyway where they've done exactly that. They've got the gaming museum, they've got a street food, effectively like a street food section downstairs which wouldn't shame Soho. And they've really made an old, it was the old co-op building, they've made a department store relevant to the 22nd century.
More interactive.
21st century.
Mm. Very cool.
So yeah.
I suppose when we're talking about... Sorry, I was just looking at the cameras. The camera's dead now.
Oh, the camera's dead.
We're just rolling straight with sound, which is fine. Other predictions within the retail space. You talk about the metaverse, these kind of things. 2023, a bit more short term. What are you thinking there?
You've probably got gathered I'm very optimistic. I'm very, very positive. I think, you know, we haven't bounced back properly from COVID yet. So although we're all out and we're shopping and we're not wearing masks and we're feeling like life's returned to normal, it hasn't. And I think there's this mood out there, obviously, of tightening the purse strings because, you know, things don't feel great and should we spend at Christmas? And fashion gets targeted because it's, you know, the sustainability issue and it's the greatest polluter on the planet and so on. So people say all that, right? And then they do go out and shop anyway, and they do go out on flights anyway. I mean, I don't think there's an influencer out there who's had one flight less than they had last year. Whether they're going on posting about, you know, I don't fly because it pollutes the planet, then they go and do it. All the pop stars, all the people that went to, you know, the climate change summit all flew there, you know. Greta Thunberg going in a boat across the Atlantic amused me because apparently it costs 3 times as much in carbon emissions than had she just flown there. So there's a lot of nonsense. I'm not anti-Greta Thunberg, but there's a lot of nonsense about all that sort of thing. So I think, you know, humans being what we are, we're sociable, you know, we like to dress up, we like to wear makeup, we like to have our hair cut, we like to flirt and socialise with each other. So I'm really positive that it will come back. And it's probably just, we're still in quite a big transition period. COVID fast-forwarded the decline of, not just the decline of the high street, but the decline of some of the retailing that was going on. And there's a quick question for both of you. Name a brand, you don't have to answer it, it's just a rhetorical question, but name a brand that you thought was amazing that's gone bust and you can't do it because there isn't one. All the ones that have gone bust, pretty much were rubbish, or they'd had their time, or they were, here's one that you might have said, and you wouldn't say because you're guys, right? Topshop. People go, oh, Topshop. No. Topshop was terrible retailing for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Philip Green obviously became a pariah and kind of virtually the most hated man in British fashion. But you went to the shops, the staff were arrogant towards you, the shop was on plastic, the stuff was on plastic hangers, the shops looked like they were from the 1980s. I'm saying this all to you very, very rudely about Topshop. It's not here anymore, and there's people that are Topshop fans and perhaps Topshop former employees go, oh, he's talking, don't know what he's talking about. I interviewed for the top job there. And when I did the interview, I did a very detailed critique of it about 8 years ago. And it was terrible then, and it was terrible just before it shut its doors. It lost its way. They had one genius person there, Jane Shepherdson, who was like the creative director, and she was a genius. When she went, after one row too many with Philip, it ended, right? Mm-hmm. So there's nothing, there's nobody that's going bust that deserves to still be in business. You're out because you're not relevant anymore, because you don't offer what people want, because you're not exciting. So my answer to the question, very long-winded, is I think 2023 will see the start of and the realisation that actually, if you make it exciting, if you make it relevant, if you make it brilliant, which people are doing now, but it will really start to accelerate. I mean, I walked up Berwick Street last night, and there's lots of great little stores. So that's, you know, always been the slightly edgier bit of Soho, but that will spill out, and other, the brands and all those creative people that run the bigger brands are going to be going down those streets and seeing what's happening and going, oh, actually, I like the way they're doing it. I like the way they've kitted out their shop. I like the way that that's happening. And it's still going to be required. Mm-hmm. And the use of a shop's going to change, though. So you'll end up with a shop, which we used to always say in Ted Baker, the shop's a showroom for the brand. That's going to just accelerate. So you'll realise, yeah, you're not going to, you might not make the money to make the rent. You might not make the money to make the thing pay. But you still want a physical presence because people can see the brand, they can collect the goods if they want to come and collect the goods. Yep. You can do exclusives, you can do limited editions, you can do events, you can have influencers turn up, you can have video shoots. You can. One of the things I was doing with Skinny Dip was they had a in one of their stores, they had like a glittery wall and a neon wall. And they made a comment to me in one of the shops. They said, oh, you know, you'd be amazed how many young girls come in here and want to have their photo taken against a glittery wall with a neon. I went, no, I wouldn't be amazed at all. I come from Ted Baker. Every single shop had you know, features in it you could take photos of, and we encouraged it. So, no, what you actually need to do is put that in the other seven shops. Put the same sort of thing. A neon phrase, a word. Angel wings is a big thing that young girls love. Mm-hmm. Angel wings on a wall, if they spray paint that. Every girl wants to have their photo taken with the angel wings.
Yeah.
So I've got three daughters, so they've all done that the angel wing thing. So I feel really positive. So physical retail can have a fight back if people are skillful enough to make it entertaining and exciting. And it's not all about making it experiential. That's a load of nonsense. You know, experiential is a word that's kind of overused. Make it experiential. What does that mean? Great experience. A great experience is good service, good product, exciting environment, attention from the staff to you. Mm-hmm. When I went into one of the shops, won't name them, on Berwick Street, two people completely ignored me. I know what they thought. Older guy, probably not our customer, barely even acknowledged me. So I made them say hello to me, and I made them tell me who the company was. And by the end of it, I said, you know, I actually bought pretty much the first thing that you ever created, one of these. Did you? Oh, wow. Oh, that's amazing. Mm. When was that? And I said, well, about 8 years ago when the company founded. Oh, wow. And suddenly they got, but they were going to definitely reject me. Yeah. You don't reject anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not being funny. What's it called? Ralph Lauren's like 80-odd, Armani's 85. Did what? You would not serve them if they came into your shop?
Yeah.
Because they're old guys? Yeah. I'm not being funny about
it. They don't even look that old.
No, well, thank you. No, that's interesting. Thank you. I don't, but I don't get it. I don't get it. Everyone's a customer.
Yeah.
You know, I could be, as I probably actually was, looking for my son. You know, he's 18. He'd be exactly their target customer. Mm. But I don't even get that. Kit, that's a good question from earlier. Kit doesn't have a target customer. Okay. Ted Baker used to say, we don't have a target customer, it's everybody. Mm-hmm. Anyone. My dad used to wear Ted Baker when he was in his 70s, and you can wear it when you're 18. That was what we used to say. Whether that's true or not now, I don't know.
Yeah.
With Kit, absolutely, this shirt could suit anybody. Mm-hmm. Our trousers could suit anybody. That's the idea. We're not trying to make it bland, because that can also be bland. We're just trying to make them a bit more every man could wear. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the vintage brands. Well, your grandfather would have worn those kind of things.
Yeah.
You know, I've got an amazing picture of my granddad wearing a Henley shirt with big, wide leather braces. And it's the coolest picture. He looks like he's modelling for him. He's actually just sitting on a hill after a hot walk and taking his shirt off. So that's what he's sitting there in. Mm-hmm. But if you could produce exactly the trousers, braces and Henley that he's wearing, it was his underwear, it was his vest. But if you could create that perfectly as it looked to the picture, they would sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, people would buy it.
And I don't think that's just a moment in time. I think there's a vintage workwear place that people, you know, every year that people like vintage workwear. Yeah. You come around here, it's all everyone wears.
Definitely. So I'll start to tie things up now. First of all, thank you for your time. I'm going to give you one last question that's sort of our go-to at the end.
Right.
And I don't think it can have a long answer, so we'll see.
No,
I make the joke. We've joked
what
with
do
Chris.
You mean there, Theo? Have I spoken for too long?
No. Favourite retail brand to buy from?
Favourite retail brand to buy from? Well, the short answer is Kit London, but no.
It can't be your own brand, actually. We should specify that.
No, a very strange brand I love buying from, Mertz B. Schwanen, so it's German. B. Schwanen stands for Blue Swan. And I don't know exactly the history of how they sort of revived, but there's a guy, I believe, from the UK who went to an old factory in, I'm going to say Saarbrücken, somewhere like that in Germany. And there was a factory that had been producing Henley-style workwear T-shirts, sweatshirts for like 100 years. And they were on their backside, they're not trading well, whatever, about a dozen years ago. And he raised some finance, he started, and then all the product is made exactly as it was made 100 years ago. It comes in a brown box where they've just stamped a blue swan on the front in a really rough style. And I just love that brand. I mean, I've got four or five, probably more than that, probably about 10 different types of Henleys and sweatshirts from there. They're all indestructible. I can imagine I'll have them for the rest of my life.
Awesome.
And I just think that's a really amazing version of a vintage brand, modern way of like training it and selling it, but they've kept all the stuff that made it great. They still stick it in the same box it came in 50 years ago. So that would be a brand I recommend it to people, but I just love it. In fact, actually, I haven't bought anything from there for a while because I think I've got all the main things I want.
Right. So, and they're going to last you.
Yeah,
so.
I've got one in my bag out there. I'll show you when we finish the chat. Yeah. But yeah, they're just amazing. They're so well made. They're circular knit, which is important. So there's no seams.
Wow.
No body seams.
Yeah, gotcha.
So it feels really nice on the body.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a little bit more expensive, but this is another big, really important point perhaps to end on. Things should be, if they're proper, not, I don't mean luxury here, but expensive quite often, it's for a reason. You know, it's the best fabric, you know, it's Pima cotton, or it's the construction, the make, it's the extra stitching. And the other one would be the better, more restrained stuff in Stone Island. It's so well made. Mm. You know, Massimo Osti's my fashion hero. And Massimo Osti created Stone Island, CP Company, 4 or 5 others. And if you read, he died very young, 53, 54. If you read the story of that man's life and what he created, all he wanted was to make these products that were indestructible. So if you go to the Stone Island shop, there's a lot of very bright, acid bright coats and so on. That's not my thing, but the simpler stuff they do, a beautifully made sweatshirt or a polo shirt, amazing.
Wow. Yeah,
that was a short answer.
No, thank you.
quite short compared to.
No, but genuinely, I think from all the listeners, from ourselves, really appreciate having you on. And I think every word that you did put out there was genuinely worth listening to. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Theo.
I guess we'll wrap it up there. I haven't actually done an outro yet, and he said you can do the outro this time.
This is your moment. Needless to say,
he'll be doing the next outro. But thank you for coming on.
Great to meet you both, Harry, Theo. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good one. Oh, wait, before we go,
you nearly messed up the outro. It's a double outro.
Yeah. Where can people find out about you, Kit, your consultancy work? How can they get in touch?
So the usual place these days, LinkedIn. So I'm on there, Chris Brown. But yeah, Kit London, you can just contact me direct. If you go to our customer help desk, I answer it.
Okay.
And actually, that's just great fun, Theo. I love answering directly and personally to people. And you know, let's say we do get big. I want to make certain I have somebody on that, like ridiculously on it. You know, writing personal notes. I've had the most surprising response when I've written hi, this is Chris here, founder of Kit. Oh, I'm sorry you had that problem. And I go into real detail and they write back to me, go, oh, I want to keep it now. You've been so nice. Or I want to buy another one. Wow, I wasn't expecting to. I mean, we're only a little company, so it's not that big a deal meeting the founder. But I love that. I love that. That's proper old fashioned retailing.
Yeah.
So that's nice. Great fun.
Well, that's perfect. Thanks very much again
for
your time.
Thank you.
The triple outro.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
WTF is Retail, presented by Excellent Zephyr.